Welcome to the No Film School podcast. I'm Liz Nord, editor-in-chief of No Film School. And this week, I'll be chatting with director Otto Bell and producer Stacey Reese from the magnificent documentary, The Eagle Huntress. When I first saw the Sundance Favorite at TIFF this year, I wrote that I might have seen the perfect documentary. It's got all the elements, incredibly charismatic protagonists, majestic landscapes, underlying social issues, and a classic David and Goliath tale. In this case, our David is actually a 13-year-old girl named Aishel Pan, who's determined to learn the dangerous art of hunting game with eagles in the frozen wilderness. And the Goliath is the 12-generation-long eagle hunting tradition that has never, ever allowed a female to participate. Fortunately, her father, a champion eagle hunter himself, agrees to train her despite objections of the community elders. The story behind the film is almost as dramatic. I interviewed Bell at TIFF about the Herculean production efforts that his small crew underwent to shoot the sweeping film in the mountains of Mongolia. Today's conversation picks up where we left off. Otto Bell and I are joined by producer Stacey Reese, who came on to shepherd the project to completion when Bell already had an amazing story on his hands, but had run entirely out of resources. Reese was handpicked by executive producer Morgan Spurlock, due in part to her impressive track record with films like Suited, The Diplomat, and Lena Dunham's It's Me, Hillary. So hi, Stacey. Hi, Otto.
Hello, Liz. Thanks for having us.
Nice to see you.
Welcome. We have already had your cinematographer, Martina Radwan, or one of your camera people on the show, and Otto and I met at TIFF and did a long talk about the amazing production behind this amazing film. So I want to start today with kind of the point at which Stacey got involved. So Otto, can you first kind of catch us up with where you were at the stage when you kind of reached out?
I was about two-thirds of the way through the film. We just finished the Eagle Festival. I was flat broke. Actually, I was worse than broke. I was in debt to the bank. And Morgan Spurlock, I'd met Morgan Spurlock. He had seen the first 10 minutes of the film and, you know, really turned everything around and found us a place to edit and introduced us to financiers and all sorts of things. And it was clear I was going back to work, and it was for a day job, and it was clear that we were going to need, you know, a really great producer to come on board and bring a bit of law and order to what had been kind of a passion project. And so I was looking around for a great producer. And it's funny because both Morgan Spurlock and my lawyer Mark Simon both suggested Stacey independently, and I put a lot of store by that, you know, but I respect both those folks enormously. So when they both suggested that I should meet Stacey Reese, I thought, okay, great. Well, you know, they must be right. And they were.
Thanks.
And so you two met. What was that initial meeting like?
Where was it?
We met at the Mercer Kitchen.
That's right, with Sharon Chang.
Right, but yeah. I had met... this sort of came about. Otto was in Mongolia filming the winter hunt scenes, and Mark Simon and Morgan and I were all at Sundance, and I was there with a different film, and ended up talking about this project that both of them were involved in. And when we got back from Sundance, I got this phone call from Morgan. He said, come to my office. I want to show you something. And he showed me those scenes that Otto had shared with him. And, I mean, they were captivating, and Aishel Pan was so, like, compelling as a character. And I was like, I must work on this project. And then Morgan made the introduction to Otto. And very quickly after that, I think it was the next week after I'd seen the footage, Otto and I met with Sharon Chang, our other producer, at the Mercer Kitchen and talked about the project. And I basically think I said to them at the time, like, I'll do anything to work on this. I was so interested in it.
What was it that grabbed you so?
I mean, I think that watching what Morgan showed me was the scene, and it was the first scene that Otto filmed, where Aishel Pan is climbing up the mountain to get her baby eagle. And to see a young woman so bravely, you know, scaling those peaks and the relationship with her father, and I was really drawn to that story, to their relationship, to her fearless attitude. And I felt like that was something that was a universal theme and could appeal to people everywhere, even though this was in another language in a country very, very far away.
So then what happens next? You've got this amazing idea. You've got a bunch of footage. There's a lot of potential. You get hooked up with, quote unquote, the right people, but there's still no money. Like, how do you push the project forward?
Yeah, no, the money started coming in at that point as well. That was when we were in a position to bring Stacey on board. And she just brought a great deal of law and order to things. So she really took it by the scruff of the neck. I mean, look, this was my first film. You know, to this day, I feel bad about the state of the rushes and the raw footage. You know, it was a dog's dinner that I dropped off in Stacey's lap, and she worked exhaustively with Pierre Takala, our editor, and Adam Sonnenfeld at Warrior Poets at Morgan's Production Company, just to catalog it. They undertook this incredible Herculean task of getting it all translated. She was running Stacey was running a team of translators in Kazakhstan.
Wow.
I mean, like 7 or 8 of them working nonstop for months. Because I was pretty annoying probably in that I wanted like literally every scrap of dialogue and interviewed, translated, just so we, because, you know, I had so little idea what was actually being said a lot of the time, especially in the Verite scenes. So it was a big undertaking. I mean, binders and binders of transcripts. And Stacey, you know, she managed it all.
So Stacey, you were really hands-on. It wasn't that you came on to just be part of the distribution.
No, I mean, it was a small team, and it's a low budget film. I mean, I think that I've been asked this question a lot when we've screened it at film festivals, that it's so big and beautiful and exquisite that people assume that it cost a lot of money to make. And it was a very small team in the field, and it was a very small team in post. And, we all worked really hard on it, and it's, you know, it's probably one of the smaller budget films I've worked on. And, I think it was that the thing that we all shared was that we all fell in love with Asha Pan and her family, and we all were so motivated to come together and tell her story and tell it in the most authentic way that we could. And so, and it was great. We did the edit out of Warrior Poets, and we got tons of support from them, from post supervisor to assistant editor, and both Morgan and his partner, Jeremy Chelnick's notes. And it was, you know, having that type of experience behind the project, I think it really benefited. So, you know, we were on a tight deadline too. We wanted to premiere at Sundance. We had to raise still 50% of the budget to finish and keep the edit going. So, you know, I felt a lot of pressure. In fact, I just said to someone like, oh, this time last year, we were in that race for Sundance, trying to find out if we were going to get in and raising money and finishing the film. And this fall feels very, very different. You know, the film's coming out. We had our premiere. And so it feels very exciting a year later to be in this position.
So since you sort of brought us there, once you know, there's one thing that's finishing the film. There's this other film that's the year after. So what is everyone's kind of role in that? What does the producer do, or what did the various team of producers do? What does the director do at that point? What are the things that need to get done?
Right now?
No, like once the film's sort of in the can or almost in the can.
Oh, right. Well, we spent a good deal, we blocked out the film. You know, we spent a good deal of time wrestling with, you know, the order in which we were going to tell the story. And ultimately, it was kind of circuitous. We actually just came back to sticking with a chronology, just sticking with the chain of events as they occurred. Mm-hmm. I knew I wanted to start the film with a sacrifice. I'd always had that in my mind. I wanted to start the film with an old eagle hunter returning his bird to the wild. But then from there, we jumped straight into telling Asha Pan's story. We had the luxury of doing so because we were there when she stole the eagle and took that first step. And then everything sort of unfolded from that. And there's kind of this predetermined chain of events that Ashurpan goes through to become a huntress.
So, it's not like other films where you're really figuring out what your story is.
Well, that's exactly it. Yeah. Although we did wrestle with a bunch of ideas. We did think about moving, you know, acts around and things like that. But no, it wasn't like, I mean, I when I was getting to know Stacey, I went to see The Diplomat, her last film, which is a cracker of a film.
One of my favorites from the year it premiered at Tribeca.
Yeah, I loved it. David Holbrook did a great job with it. And then, but I could see, you know, we talked a lot about that, and she talked about sort of, well, how do we get into that story? You know, she's dealing with 50 plus interviews, and how do you crack that narrative? We didn't, you know, although we went through the due diligence of thinking about it, we ultimately ended up just going with the chain of events. Yeah. So that was one thing. We would talk about story a lot. And, you know, different scenes as well. So once we had our sort of act structure, you know, we would talk a great deal about which scene and would go where and how we would tell that story, how much of Ashurpan's femininity would we bring to the fore versus the other side of her character, which is quite determined and steely, and getting that balance right. I don't know, what else did we get up to?
Well, I guess what so I was really asking about was less about the editorial process and more about once there's a film, once you've got enough of something to show to folks. I think a lot of, especially newer filmmakers, don't really realize then there's almost as much work left as making the film itself.
Oh, yeah, the whole thing starts again, doesn't it?
And of course, a producer has a huge part in that. So in your team, what were the sort of different roles and what were the things that you had to accomplish once the film was done?
Well, I think the first thing we had to accomplish is once we got into Sundance, it was getting noticed. I mean, yes, it's a big achievement to get into Sundance, but lots of films get into Sundance. Mm-hmm. And our film was an independent film and it didn't have distribution yet. And
it was in the kids category.
It was in the kids category, and it was a foreign language documentary, and we were concerned that we might get lost, and we had big plans for this film. And so, you know, Morgan, I think this is like his true expertise. He's like, we need to get stuffed eagles and we should put stuffed eagles in the seats at the premiere. And we should get, you know, real eagles that come to the festival with Ashurpan so people can all get their Instagram moment. And so we plan this huge event at Sundance, all of us, where we had received an outreach grant from the Artemis Foundation, which is Regina Scully's foundation.
Yeah.
And that allowed us to bring Ashurpan and her family to Park City.
Which is no small feat, because in Kazakhstan.
In Mongolia.
Northwest Mongolia.
Okay. Yeah. And so they came. We brought eagles. We had stuffed animals. We had pins. We had a gear. We had a big team of people.
Will say, you getting those eagles there, that was a mission. Well done with that. Because it turns out, you know, I was working with my day job, and it turns out that it's really hard to own an eagle in America, for good reason. And obviously, the family couldn't bring their eagles from Mongolia. So Stacey went on a mission to find eagles, golden eagles in America, and we ended up, you found the Comanche people of Oklahoma, right?
Right, and they brought
they drove to Park City and brought their birds. They're allowed to have them for religious reasons.
Oh, but, my God, like a thing you that, never thought you would do. I mean, that's what I was kind of getting at.
But
it's
that
like,
sort
as
of
a
made
producer,
all the difference. I mean, it really did. I mean, it caught the attention of everyone. It caught the attention of Tom Bernard at Sony Pictures Classics and others. And our screenings were sold out.
Wow.
There were tons of buyers in our first screening. It was so exciting. I mean, we had CAA representing the film. And we were, you know, very lucky. We made a sale. We made a foreign sale as well. And with that, we were sort of off and running. But again, you know, then we still had more work to do, because people think you get to Sundance, you sell your film, and, you know, you're finished. But
well,
that
as you
was...
mentioned, here we are almost a year later, and you guys are doing press here with me, and you've been doing it all day. And you, I mean, tell us more. What happens next?
What did we do? I mean, we did a couple of things. We wanted to make some you know, few changes to the film. Daisy Ridley had come on as executive producer just days leading into Sundance.
Mm.
And We added some of her narration to the film, so that will be part of the theatrical release, will be with her narration, which I think for a G-rated film that's really geared towards a family, it, you know, it's not a lot of narration, but it gives you the steps it takes to become a full-fledged eagle hunter. And I think for families with young children, it allows them to follow along in an easier way. And we received a fledgling fund grant to do outreach screenings, which we're in the process of setting up with Sony as well. We've been at festivals around the world, which is enormous amount of work to, you know, get them all the materials and the prints and... what else have we been doing? We've been so busy. I can't...
No, there's been an endless list of jobs. But I mean, I will say just more broadly than that, having Stacey was really important to me because I was conscious as well. I was, throughout all of this, I'm still a man telling a young girl's story. Mm-hmm. And having Stacey and Sharon Chang, our other producer, having just... surrounding the project with women and listening for a woman's point of view, not only on the editorial side, but throughout this process has been really valuable for me and, you know, I think probably prevented me making a bunch of missteps or, you know, you've got to know what you don't know.
Did anyone give you a hard time about that over the course of this? Did anybody say, hey, no. Weirdo, you're making a film about a young girl?
No.
It was just something that you
Nobody
felt
said that,
personally aware
yeah,
of.
Yeah, same reason I had Martina Radwan, who you've interviewed, because my crew was male. Mm. And I was conscious that, you know, a young girl might not open up as much to three sweaty English blokes in, you know, waterproofs. So that's why Martina lived with the family for a few weeks and brought back some wonderful verite. Because about halfway through, I started worrying that I don't have enough of those. We had a lot of nice intimate moments, but I was conscious that we wanted more. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Stacey, you know, that carried through editorial, that's carried through this whole rollout as well.
And I feel like I, in a way, I already know the answer to this because the film is so charming and you want to believe in the characters, like you said from the beginning. But a lot of the work you're talking about that happens after it's out there and after the rush of Sundance feels like, it sounds like, and I know it feels like a bit of a grind. So how do you kind of keep the enthusiasm up during that whole period?
I mean, for me, I feel like when I'm approached with projects, I really think about, is this a project that I want to live with for the amount of time it's going to take for it to be released? And that can vary. Like The Diplomat took 5 years to make. And never once in that process did I ever sort of lose the enthusiasm or lose sight of the believing in that film. And I feel the same way about this film. And I think it's really important, especially, I mean, I feel lucky I'm in that position because I get to develop projects that I care about and projects get brought to me that I really care about and I'm lucky that I get to choose. But I think it's really important that you should work on things that you can live with for that period of time. Because again, so much of the work starts when the film is finished. And I think that the reason to make films is so those messages are out in the world. I mean, film is such a valuable tool for people as an educational tool. And like, it's such a shame if you make a movie and then it has all these great messages and not that many people get to see it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's so important for that reason.
Yeah, two things from me. And I really mean this. I did have a deep sense of responsibility to make this film as big as it could be, to do justice to the family that we met and who are now part of my family going forward, really. So that drives you on, definitely. And, you know, shame on you if you think it's a grind. You know, you should be damn lucky to make films. Just generally, not many people get to. So there's no room for whinging like that. And then also, you know, another sort of coping mechanism for me was my work, was my day job, you know?
So you kept the day job throughout.
Yeah. And it's nice to have something to dive into, you know, a separate sort of, call it a distraction, call it another... You know, it's nice to have a place to go to throw yourself into, because then when you come back to, your film to the project, you feel fresh again. You feel excited about it again. It's not all consuming. I found that very helpful.
That's actually a great segue, because I'm interested in both of your pasts and the sort of idea of a sustainable career in this industry. Mm-hmm. You, I understand, Otto, come from advertising and some TV production, and yep. I know Stacey comes from the news and docs TV world. So I guess the first question is, what did you learn from your career history that you can bring into doc filmmaking?
I mean, for me, I came out of news. I worked for NBC News for 10 years. So I think I learned there how to tell a story, you know, how to find a beginning and a middle and an end, and how to, tell a compelling story. And, I also think I learned to do things, resourcefully on a budget. I think it's important with documentary films to be accountable to your investors or to the people that, give you money, even for foundations that give you money to make the film, that you come in on budget and that you're smart about how you're spending that money. And I definitely learned that from my work at NBC.
Yeah, you are very good at that. Yeah.
Thanks.
You are.
That's part of the Law and Order.
Yeah.
I find that actually one of the most challenging parts for me personally. Yeah, because there's so much you always want to do, and then you want to be fair to everyone, and yeah, everything costs money.
Right. And also teams of people. I mean, at NBC, and often it was under a deadline, like running teams of people covering wars, covering earthquakes, covering elections. So the idea of working on a team of people from Kazakhstan, where translations were happening, to Soho, where edit was happening, to Mongolia, where the shoot was happening. While that could be daunting, it wasn't something that I had. I was used to doing that. That was something that felt very comfortable, even if it meant waking up early and so I could speak to people in different time zones.
Right.
For me, yeah, my background is in more commercial, branded content and short form documentary work, and I made more films outside of the country in foreign languages than I had here in the US. So I wasn't really. I should have probably been more daunted, more phased by the idea of going to Mongolia. In retrospect, I definitely should have been. But I'm used to working through translators with real people to elicit emotive stories. I think the other thing I learned from the commercial world is high production standards. You know, they give you. I never made the $1 million 30-second Super Bowl spots. I was often taking a corner of that budget, a little clip of it, and being allowed to go off and experiment and make documentary style work. That said, I wasn't allowed to compromise the commercial production standards. That brand, that client, they still want it to look damn good. They still want it to look polished and beautiful. So I spent, 7 or 8 years directing short form stuff on smaller budgets and figuring out ways to get that polished premium look. And that we brought a lot of that to this production, whether it's Simon Niblett and his bag of tricks, his wonderful drone work and his cranes and all of those things that give you that big cinematic look, but with, two or three people.
We did talk a lot about the shooting process when we met at TIFF, but I hadn't made that particular connection. It makes a lot of sense that you have that sort of commercial standard of visuals.
Yeah.
And it shows in the film. You don't look like someone who just... It doesn't look like someone picked up a camera to make their first doc. It looks like someone has high-quality production experience.
Yeah. I think, just because something's true, it doesn't mean that it can't be beautiful.
Right. Right.
And honestly, I think especially with somebody as compelling and beautiful and I think important as Ashiel Pan, you damn well better make it look good. You should do justice to that. I reject the idea that pure documentary should be grainy and rough, and it doesn't have to be that way. I understand that circumstances sometimes demand that and dictate that it is that way.
Sure.
But it's that doesn't define a documentary.
Career-wise, again, you mentioned, Otto, you're juggling still with your full-time job. And Stacey, I mean, every time I look up, she's working on another project.
I've got a lot more coming.
It's so impressive and kind of intense. So how do you guys juggle it? How do you have one project in mind while you're working on another one, or two or three projects, or do your day job and do your night job? And how do you manage it all and your families?
I think it's about having strong teams of people. It's working with, putting together a strong team. I mean, I have two films right now in production that will come out next year. And just working with, you know, really good editors, really good directors. I think you can, I don't like to have multiple films at the exact same stage, but one of them is really far along in edit. One of them, we're putting together a sizzle reel to go out and sell the project. So this is coming out. So there are three different films at three different stages. Mm. So I think it, for me, I do want to have a career as a documentary filmmaker. And I think that to have a sustainable career, you have to work on multiple films at one time, and you have to have a lot of balls in the air and, you know, have some things you're developing with a longer plan. And it's a juggle. But again, I mean, I feel really lucky to be able to do this. And I love what I do. And I have two young children. And often I work from home. So I get to be there when they walk in the door if I'm not on location in Mongolia with Otto. And, you know, just that check-in and being able to have a more flexible schedule. Certainly, it's when I was in news, I didn't have that as much. Mm-hmm. So I really, really appreciate that.
Yeah, I actually recommend juggling things mm-hmm. because honestly, I think it keeps you fresh. Mm-hmm. I think it, and it also concentrates the mind. I often wonder what it would have been like if this had been all I was thinking about. I think I would have been unbearable.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would, well, even more unbearable.
I didn't say anything.
I think, I think it's you know, when you switch from day job to this, you know, passion project, you're focused on, all right, what do we have to get done? You know, we have this amount of time. I can only give this amount of time to it. What's important? Let's cut to it. And I find that very helpful. And same when you go back to work as well. It's like, well, I've got to get through X, Y, and Z so I can get to Warrior Poets and see where the guys are at.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it, I think it keeps you, you're fresh. I can't imagine. I would, maybe you would just spiral. I fear I would spiral into almost an obsessive, you know, too close, can't see the wood for the trees sort of perspective.
Mm-hmm.
If I was solely absorbed by a single project.
You know, I just want to chime in. I think what Otto was saying too, in terms of having strong teams, like we did have Warrior Poets behind this, which is great. And for me, I'm working on another project with them. I've worked on a few films with Lena Dunham and Jenny Connor's production company, A Casual Romance. I've worked with HBO. So having all of those big name people behind you and behind your projects, I will say really helps to be able to juggle lots of different projects.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of like checks and balances and smart people that are weighing in on decisions.
That's very
so
true.
I think that's really key. Like when, you know, for me, like I think a huge key to my success has been those partnerships. Mm-hmm. And like, while I'm an independent producer and company of one, it's really about the power of collaboration.
Yep. I definitely learned throughout this whole thing that there is no heroism in trying to make a film alone.
Mm.
You the quicker you can surround yourself with a shield wall of people.
Of Warrior Poets, for example.
Yeah. Well, and Sharon and Stacey particularly, you know, to have people, and there's validation in it as well. You realize you're not crazy, that that you do have something, mm-hmm. and people are every bit as willing and every bit as committed as you are and care just as much. And once you assemble that, you know, you become unstoppable.
So I'm sure a lot of our listeners who are all over the world and not necessarily in New York or connected in any way are saying, totally, that sounds great. How do I find those people? What would you say to them?
I always get asked that at film festivals also. I mean, I said to this woman the other day, I spoke on this panel and she raised her hand in the back and she said, you know, I think a great idea for a film and I'm not a filmmaker. You know, what should I do? And I said, well, there's four people on this panel. You should email all of us your idea. And I'm sure we'll all look at it. And, you know, and I think that that's part of it. I think when Otto reached out to Morgan with this story, that they didn't really know each other beforehand. So I think that we're all storytellers. We're all looking for compelling stories. I think that many people are accessible in this industry. And I also think it's a fairly low barrier to entry in terms of making your own film. Everyone has an iPhone with a camera, and you can go and you can start recording a story that you want to tell. And maybe that's not going to be the footage that's going to end up in the final film. But if you have access, or you have a story or talent that no one else has, any number of these people will be interested in it. Mm-hmm. So if you can just show your proof of concept, it can get you quite far. And I feel like every year there are films that come out that are from people who aren't filmmakers that just have a very powerful story to tell.
Yeah, yeah. And look, it's not about getting HBOs and Morgan Spurlock and all these. You don't have to have a household name to make a film. You know, there's plenty of people who have the skills necessary to get you to where you need to go, who are just as willing and just who are just as eager to club together. So you've got an idea, you'll find somebody who is at the same stage of their career, of their trajectory as you are in an edit room. Mm. You'll find the same person who all they want to do is go out and shoot with this new camera that they've saved, or maybe they've bought on layaway. You know, there are for every producer, there is a cameraman, there is an editor, there are people who are just as eager to get going. So all you got to do is club together and find those people, and then you build your village and you're unstoppable.
Those are such encouraging words to wrap up on. Is there anything else that either of you would like to say about this film, The Eagle Huntress, or anything else you're working on and want folks to know about?
Well, this film comes out November 2nd in Los Angeles and New York, and then it will hit 50 cities between then and Thanksgiving, and it's coming out in the UK and France around the Christmas holidays and in many other places around the world. So I hope that many of these listeners will get a chance to see it no matter where they are.
Yeah, I do hope everybody gets inspired by Ashiel Pan's story. It's a lot of the reason why we saw through this production, actually, is because we were inspired by her determination. It rubs off on you.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations and thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Otto and Stacy, for speaking with me, and thank you all for listening. The Eagle Huntress is opening in theaters throughout the U.S. all month. To see when it's coming to your town, go to sonyclassics.com/TheEagleHuntress. Please subscribe to the No Film School podcast, where you'll hear more great interviews like this one every other Monday, and our Indie Film Weekly news show every Thursday morning. We also invite you to visit nofilmschool.com to learn more about the craft of filmmaking.